Okay, so my topic is sensory imagining, the kind of imagining you go in for when you visualize a castle, or imagine the taste of manchego cheese, or imagine Beethoven's 8th played on a brass band. And I'm going to take my cue from Gilbert Ryle, though the paper is not really about Ryle, so if many of you are Ryle addicts, you'll be disappointed, I think. So Ryle held a very radically different view about imagining, sensory imagining, I'll just say imagining from now on, than a lot of psychologists and philosophers across the centuries, and in particular in the present time. Those people all follow Hume, more or less, in thinking that sensory imagining is something like a pale shadow of sensing. At its heart lies a state that is like a sensory state, but it differs in some way or other, no doubt partly phenomenologically, now done its connections to belief and action. But it's be understood in relation to sensing itself, to perceiving in its sensory aspect. Ryle opposes this picture, deploying something of a Kantian distinction between sensing and ordering it under knowledge. He argues that sensory imagining is in fact nothing more than the deployment of sensory knowledge. So here are some quotations from Ryle to make the point. Picturing, however, so far from having or being akin to having some visual sensations, is compatible with having no such sensations and nothing akin to them. There is nothing akin to sensations, by which I take it he means anything like a sensation would just be another sensation. Here he is again. Seeing Helvellyn in one's mind eye is one utilization among others of the knowledge of how Helvellyn should look. Or in one sense of the verb, it is thinking how it should look. So visualizing Helvellyn is a deployment of knowledge of what Helvellyn would look like. And in one sense of the verb, it's thinking about what it would look like. And finally, therefore, visualizing a mountain does involve the thought of having a view of Helvellyn, and is therefore a more sophisticated operation than that of having a view of Helvellyn. It's more sophisticated twice over, I suppose. Once in that it's higher order, because it involves thinking about having a view, and once in that it involves thinking, which sensing does not. Okay, now I don't want to defend Ryle's view full on. I'm very sympathetic to the broad approach, in particular to its opposition to the basic Humean picture, which I think dominates a lot of contemporary thinking about sensory imagining. But we can't be full-on Ryleans because, unsurprisingly, given Ryle in The Concept of Mind, the book from which these quotations come, is a full-on behaviorist. In the end, his theory can't give a decent account of the phenomenology of sensory imagining. It gets a lot further than you might think, given that he simply talks about it as a form of knowing. He has resources at his disposal, going in some way towards accommodating this phenomenology, but in the end, in my view, you can't get it all right. So what I aim to do in this talk is to flesh out most of the Ryleian schema just described in these quotations. I'm going to try and tell you what the knowledge involved in sensory imagining is, and I'm going to try and suggest it has a key role, but I'm not going to suggest it has does all the work. I'm going to solve the problem that Ryle had in phenomenology by making a non-Ryleian concession. There is something that, if you like, is sensation-like, at the kernel of sensory imagining, and my task will be to minimize its role. And then at the end of this time, I'll try and say something about this theme being the more sophisticated operation. Okay, so the structure of the talk is as follows. I'll give you a 5-minute philosophy of perception. After all, people spend so much time on philosophy of perception these days, why don't we just cut to the quick and go through some bold assertions? On the basis of that, I'll develop a theory of sensory imagining. Then I'll try and extend it beyond its natural territory, the kind of contents it can primarily cope with. And at the end, I'll consider how Ryleian the view is. Okay, so here, I mean, I'm not as blasé as that sounds about philosophy of perception, it's just you could spend your life giving papers on philosophy of perception. I need to help my talents in philosophy of perception to get the paper going. So what I now do will be rather summary, and we'll see the controversial for some of you, I'm sure. Okay, anyway, I'm going to give you in the form of 5 simple claims. So firstly, the way certain properties appear in perception varies with context or our relation to them.
So, if you are looking at a cube, then the way something cubic looks changes with your angle of it. If you're looking at the colour of the floor, then the way it looks changes with the fall of light on it, both the amount of light and the quality of the light. If you're listening to a fire engine passing on the street, it makes a difference whether the window is open or closed. All these changes in your relations to perceptual objects affect how they appear. Nonetheless, you see this to be a cube. This is not a cube, I realise. This is just some squares on a board. Suppose you're looking at a cube. You see the object that you're looking at when you're seeing this face to face to be a cube across these changes. So what it is to be seen as a cube goes with looking a different way, giving different relations to that object. Similarly for the colour, the surface colour of the floor, the way it looks while looking to be yellow and brown it is, changes with light. Similarly with the sound of the fire engine as it approaches, recedes, is heard through into the medium or not. So I'm just going to call the properties, the perception of which changes across these changes in relation, non-perspectival properties. So they're things like being cubic, being the surface colour this floor is, sounding the way the fire engine is. And they're non-perspectival because, here's my second thing, the changes in the way they appear is just a change in another set of properties, what I'm going to call the perspectival properties. So let's take the cube case, which is the simplest. The different way something cubic looks with your relation to it is a matter of a shift in another property you're seeing at the same time, something Thomas Reed called visible figure. And visible figure is precisely what the name suggests, a property that can be seen. It's not itself a creature of vision, it's a genuine property. It is, as Reed puts it, a matter of the directions in which parts of a thing look to lie from the eye or the point of view. So that's a perfectly objective property, and Reed claims, and I agree, you see different instances of that property as you move around the cube. Similarly with the floor, that's a little hard to say what the perspectival property is, similarly with the sound of the fire. So it doesn't really matter whether you agree with this second claim or not, you could just substitute talk of perspectival appearances if you think there aren't these perspectival properties.
Third claim. Each of the non-perspectival properties that you can see or hear or smell or touch or taste, such as, in the case of vision, being cubic, each of these non-perspectival properties has a distinctive profile within the perspectival properties that you see. In other words, if we were to carry on this series and produce every discriminable visible figure that goes with the 3D shape of being cube, then that whole pattern would not be instantiated by any other three-dimensional shape that you can see. If you could see something of a shape other than cubic, somewhere there'd have to be a difference in the set of visible figures that present from given angles. So I'm not using this to define what these properties are. You can define what cubicness is in purely geometrical terms. But it is what makes them distinctive in experience. That's the thing. Cubes, look this way, this way, this way, this way in various orientations. Cuboids, look this way, that way, and that way. Spheres, look that way, that way, and that way, whether that's just differences from the distance.
Fourth claim. So what is it then to see a cube while simultaneously seeing one of these visible figures? Answer. It is to see the visible figure as belonging to the wider pattern of visible figures that characterize cubicness. So when you are presented with just this, you might see this just as a facade. You might just see that there's this array before you, this visible figure. You might not see what figure goes with it. If you see that it's the visible figure of a cube, then what you're doing is, in effect, placing this in this wider pattern, invisible figures, the profile, as I'll call it, that characterizes cubicness.
Now, what is it to place one of these visible figures in a pattern like that?
I want to say it's a matter of having expectations. Expectations about how the school book as your relationship with it changes. Expectations should not be thought of as beliefs. These are thoughts you couldn't frame them explicitly because you don't have terms for the visible figures in those cases. Nor should they be thought of as imaginings. You might think, oh yeah, I see this and I imagine it this way as I move in relation to it one way, that way, as I move in relation to it another way. But I don't think that's right either, and if it were, it would certainly at least complicate the story we can tell today. Rather, these sensory expectations are just a matter of something like bodily readiness, a readiness to be surprised or not by how things develop as your orientation to the object changes. So they are not, in Ryle's terms, sophisticated. They are not themselves intellectual. And yet, if you have these expectations, there's a good sense in which you have something that counts as knowledge. Knowledge of how the cube looks from different orientations. From another kind of sensory knowledge that we deploy in order to see as a cube. And that is my answer to the question to Ryle, what is this knowledge involved in sensing becomes also involved in imagining? Now, I want to be clear, if anything's too clear, that what I'm not saying, I'm not making a claim about how visual processing works, that's just as well, since I'm deploying none of the resources necessary to justify such a claim. I'm not making a claim even about what it is to perceive something as cubic, if that's to be some kind of epistemic notion. Because placing this in one of these patterns is one thing, but getting it in the right pattern with the right kind of warrant would be quite another thing. I've just told you what it is to place it. Rather, my claim is supposed to be about the way in which cubicness, and by extension all these other non-perspectival properties, the way in which cubicness can be perceptually present too. What it is, you need to see something as cubic, for an instance of cubicness, the figure in your perception, is for you to place the visible figure before you in the profile that characterizes cubes. Now that's a claim about something like the claim about what makes the phenomenology possible. And placing one visible figure in this profile, or any other perspectival property, in the profile of any other non-perspectival property, enriches perception itself. Things look different when you see this as going with these, than when you see it as going with other things, which you might also go with, or don't see it as going with anything at all. So there's a kind of change in phenomenology when you take a visible figure and see it as belonging to a certain pattern of visible figure, the one characterizing the people. Okay, so all this is summarized in the first box. What is it for a non-perspectival property F to be perceptually present to you? Well, it's firstly for you to be presented, as I'll say, with a suitable perspectival property, in this case, to see a visible figure. While secondly, placing that perspectival property in the profile that characterizes some non-perspectival property. And what does that amount to? Well, that's about three. In the case of perception, it's a matter of deploying knowledge of the sensory profile, informing expectations about how the perspectival properties will shift with your relation to the object. Now, for those of you interested in, as it were, the lie of the land, some of this stuff about profiles sounds a lot like stuff that Alvin Melly talks about. And it is a lot like it. Let me just note two things. Firstly, he's interested in the idea that these things are essentially connected to your sense of how you might move. I've made no such claim. Secondly, it's not clear that he wants to limit the content of his claims in the way I do, to just being about mode of perceptual presence. And thirdly, well done, Alva, for putting all this on the table, but it's really been on the table for a long time. It goes back at least as far as Cicero, and possibly a lot further back than that. Okay, enough philosophy of perception. So how are we going to apply this to the case of sensory imagining? Well, let me just give you the view and then explain what it is.
The view's in the second box. And the game is spot the differences from the first box, and then you'll see what the view is, at least see where the question marks, and you'll understand when the view should come. So I claim someone acts to see a visible figure as a visible figure of the cube is to place a perspectival property which you're presented in a profile. The profile that characterizes cubeness. Somewhat similarly, to visualize a cube is to put before your mind a suitable perspectival property, which you somehow place in the profile of the relevant non-perspectival property. It's to put before your mind one of these visible figures, while somehow connecting that visible figure with the others that form the profile of cubes. Here's that spelt out. To centrally imagine something bearing some non-perspectival property, like cubeness, is firstly not to be presented with a perspectival property, but to do something I call conjuring one. While secondly, placing that conjuring perspectival property within the relevant sensory profile. And what does that placing amount to? Well, it isn't a matter of having expectations, as it was in the perceptual phase. But you don't have any expectations about how things will develop in your own imagining. It is, in the end, up to you. Rather, it is to undertake something I call a series of commitments. Commitments about what other perspectival properties to conjure, given other imaginary conditions to the object. Just as you'd expect this to look this way if you moved around it, if you saw it, somewhat analogously, you undertake to conjure this, having conjured this, if you imagine the object from a different angle. That's the shape of the view. But that's just a shape of a view, unless we know what its key terms mean. And clearly there are two key terms, conjuring and commitments. So now I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay, let's get the big disappointment out of the way right now. I'm not going to say very much about what conjuring is. And that ought to disappoint you for the following reason. Not only is it a notion I'm using in my second box, my theory, but secondly, you might say, wait a minute, when I conjure a suitable perspectival property, whatever that amounts to, isn't this just one kind of imagining? If I summon to mind one of these visible figures, the one that can go with a cube, aren't I already in some sense imagining something? Never mind the cube, I'm imagining this thing. And essentially, I agree. So essentially, I agree that I'm not offering a reductive analysis of sensory imagining. However, I'm going to try and cheer you up and drag you out of the slough of despond by two maneuvers. The first maneuver is to tell you something about conjuring. And the second move is to remind you, I want whatever conjuring to play a relatively limited role in the theory of sensory imagining. So there may be an unanalyzed kernel, but it will just be a kernel. Okay, so first move. Here are two things I can say about conjuring. Firstly, whatever being presented with the visible figure is, the thing that goes on in perception, I think it involves a phenomenology that is presented, and conjuring lacks that phenomenology. The phenomenology of being presented is the phenomenology of it being as if direct realism were true. So when you are presented with a visible figure, it seems to you as if something independent of your mind is a constituent of your mental state, and its nature determines the nature of your mental state. So it is phenomenologically as if direct realism true. In contrast, and this is the first thing to know about conjuring, it ain't like that. And not only is it not like that, it is the paradigm of the state which is given to you as a representation. So if the claim I made about the phenomenology of presentation is correct, then presentation does not have a representational phenomenology. You don't seem to be related to the object by a merely representational relation. Rather, the relation which you seem to stand to it is too intimate for that. It seems to be a constituent of your mind. The way things are with you is constituting a key part by the way it is with the object. That is a representation. Imagining, in contrast, is the paradigmatic sensory representation of state. When you call one of these things to mind by doing what I call conjuring, you're merely representing one, and it's quite clear to you that that's all it is. Now, in a footnote, I tell you more about what all this means.
say what's in the footnote because it summarises in a remarkably succinct way another paper. The paper I gave last time I spoke at Moral Sciences in 2006. This, is it not, is a society with a memory, therefore I take it. Okay, that's the first thing to say about conjuring. It is the summoning of a state that is manifestly representation, where presenting is not. The second thing to say about it is, conjuring does not just involve any old representing. It involves representing in a distinctively sensory way. What content can we look to that for? Well, my former colleague Dominic Gregory is looking at some length, a nice book, The Sense and Show. And the basic idea is this: conjuring is representing in a way that captures what it is like to perceive the relevant property. So to conjure a visible figure is to represent a visible figure in a way that in some way makes manifest to you what it would be like to see them. Okay, that's all I have to say about conjuring also. Prepare your rocks, your tomatoes, your buckets of coals. We probably don't do that for the drag week anymore, I won't go there. What about commitments then? So conjuring is the first to it to clause 4 in my definition of sexual imagining. So if you like, you can just, if you find that helpful, substitute imagining for it. You imagine. And that has the features I've described, some suitable perspectival property, but then you need to place that perspectival property in the moment profile. And I say you have that in commitments, but what do I mean by that? It's the education I know this time. Well, here's what commitments are not. They are no more thought-like than expectation. So it is not that, having conjured on dreams, you think to yourself, aha. And if I were to imagine this from another angle, I would imagine this, or from yet another angle that, or from yet another angle the other. They're not intellectual in the last term, they're not verbalized things. Rather, they're something like conditional dispositions. Dispositions, if you were to imagine this from a different angle, to conjure that, or this from yet another. So you set up in yourself some complex set of conditional dispositions. If I were to imagine the object I'm currently conjuring from another angle, I would conjure such and such. And just like expectations in perception, in ideas, these commitments enrich the phenomenology of the state. So it's one thing to call to mind, to conjure, some visible figure like this, or some colour appearance like that. And it's another thing, by undertaking commitments with respect to other such perspectival properties, to place it in a sensory profile. Doing that makes a difference to the phenomenology, a difference roughly parallel to the one it made in the case of perception. Okay. Are commitments then nothing more than conditional dispositions to conjure? If they were, at least there'd be some clear set of. Unfortunately for me and for you, I just want to say no and answer that question. There is something else going on here, and there's a payoff in exploring it, which I'll give you in a minute. So, I'm going to have to be quite compressed at this point. Commitments can't just be conditional dispositions. If they were, all you have is the following. Having conjured one perspectival property, in the future you will conjure a different one. Why would that make a difference to the phenomenology of your current one? Well, you might say, it's not just that you will do this in the future, indeed you may not, but what you've done is establish in yourself a disposition to do this should such and such occur. And that's in the present. That is true. But we still just have two things that coexist in time. The conjuring now, and the disposition to conjure otherwise, given certain circumstances. Nothing ties the two together in the way required to enrich the phenomenology. What's required for that is something like this, that these are supposed to be two different appearances of one and the same thing. So what can secure that? Now that's an interesting question, and I think the answer is a little hard to pin down, but the shape of it has to be this. What secures it is some kind of activity on the part of the imaginative subject. something to sew these two things together so that they can serve the same object. Take an analogous case, this is only analogous. Sometimes separate imaginative episodes, with all their rich contents, belong together. When you're dreaming, you're here doing this, and then you're there doing that. But it's not as if the story has stopped and new one's begun. Somehow, it's all part of the same tale. Now I'm doing this, having done that. Nothing in the linguistic content of these dream states need to indicate they go together. But they certainly do, be the subject of no doubt. That kind of tying together of separate imagined episodes involves some sort of synthesizing activity on your part. Synthesizing just means it weaves these things together, and activity on your part just means you have privileged access to such objects, which you surely do. And exactly analogously, I want to say, in the case of the conjurings you actually undertake and those you would undertake when you undertake conjurings. They are bound together into a single content by some synthesizing activity of your mind. Okay. So perhaps that is too obscure to be helpful. I'm happy to talk about it more. If you get delved into this dark well, here's the payoff I promised you'd get from it. All this is, to my mind, strikingly analogous to what goes on in another area. And that area is an area which pretty clearly involves imagining. The area I've got in mind is telling a story. Suppose I tell you a story. Once upon a time there was a frog, I said. And then I go on and say some other things. Now, whatever else I do, I can't as it were to delete the frog from the story. The frog is there, and what I do later must respect its presence. It's true, the frog may have turned into a prince. That's true. But nonetheless, there's a prince who was once a frog. If I start rewriting a story, so we're in a world in which there are never frogs, something has gone wrong. All this is like what goes on when you conjure one of these and undertake commitments to do these other things. Nothing can actually prevent you, of course, from just going headlong. Maybe when you imagine this from another angle, you just imagine something with this appearance. Things have got screwed up. That's like retelling the story later, so the problem can exist. But something lays down norms, or not quite norms, but something makes it true between elaborating and betraying the earlier things you laid down. And it's the same thing in both cases. In both cases, what the storyteller says later describes the same world as was being described earlier, simply in virtue of some synthesizing activity of the storyteller. Just as in the case of conjuring later, convincing the other having conjured things. So the difference between betrayal and elaboration in both cases depends on different representations being sewn together by a synthesizing activity on the part of the person who's responsible for them. And that, it seems to me, is an important analogy. What it allows us to do would be to say why, if sensory imagining operates as I've claimed in my second box, it counts as imagining. It counts as imagining because it has something important happen with another paradigm case of imagining, telling a story. I'm not saying what they have in common is sufficient for imagining. I'm not even saying it's necessary. Maybe imagining is something like a family resemblance concept. I am saying, however, having this thing in common is important to the claims of each to count as imagining. Okay, so the view is beginning to do some work, and it's trying to do some work. It's trying to tell you why sensory imagining counts as imagining. And that raises a complementary question. Okay, if it counts as imagining, what makes it count as sensory? Why is this kind of imagining sensory as storytelling or some other kind of imagining not? And here the view gives two answers. The sort of activity I've described is sensory because A, it involves the deployment of sensory knowledge. Knowledge of how the appearance of properties change in sense perception through the relationship. But secondly, it's sensory because that knowledge is deployed to operate on a conjuring. And a conjuring, remember, is not just a manifest representative, it's a manifest representative of a sensory nature. It catches actually what it would be like to see what it represents, or to hear it, or to touch it.
Okay. Now suppose you're with me so far. People rarely are, but you know, let's just be honest.
So far I've told you what it is to sensory imagine the kind of property, the appearance of which changes with our relations to it. Cues, colours, sounds, may definitely elaborate with you for taste, smells, who knows where I'm at. But I haven't got to anything fancier than things like shape, sound, and colour. And yet it's clearly possible to imagine more than just cubes, or coloured cubes, or coloured cubes giving off noises of fire engines. You can imagine fire engines. You can imagine not just things of a certain shape, say, but things of the horses. You can imagine perhaps, you certainly can imagine in some sense, you can imagine individual horses like Red Run, a famous racehorse, long gone before even my last model scientist was. You can imagine John Wayne on Red Run. You can imagine Red Run behaving skittishly under John Wayne's breath. All these things can be done. How so on my view? How can we extend the account from non-perspectival properties, like cubicness, sound and colours, out to properties like being a horse, being a skittish horse, being a skittish horse ridden by a strong-willed rider, or even all the way up to things that don't count as being properties like John Wayne. Okay, to get that far, I'm going to have to adopt a double strategy. Once, the first strategy is the optical strategy, and the second one is where the seeing feet went out to the effect. So the first strategy is this. We just repeat the story at a higher level. If non-perspectival properties, like cubicness, figure in imagining, in virtue of our placing in profiles, conjured perspectival properties, perhaps yet other properties figure in imagining, in virtue of our placing in higher level profiles, the first order properties, the non-perspectival ones. So to imagine something that is a horse, to visualize something as a horse, is perhaps to imagine something that will be one 3D shape given one relation to it, or one set of circumstances it's in, and a different 3D shape given another relation to it, or there will be other circumstances it's in. So to imagine something horse-shaped is just to imagine something shifting across different possibilities with its actions. And to imagine it being Red Run might then be for there to be some kind of pattern in that further pattern that can be suitably profiled. You can engage with it in a way that the box codes require. So that gives us the third and final box, to centrally imagine something bearing a higher order property, just something fancier than shape and colour and sound, say, is to sensory imagine some suitable non-perspectival properties, shapes, colours, sounds and the like, while placing them within a profile of that further property. And doing that involves employing knowledge of that further profile to form commitments, to conjure non-perspectival properties of the right kind. So the story just repeats at a higher level. That's what I want to say about imagining, because that's what I want to say about perceiving. What it is for John Wayne, or a horse, to be perceptually present for you, is for the analogous story about perceiving to appear to that higher level. Now, you may think, okay, maybe that will work for some of these things, but will it work for all of them? And that's a fair question. At some point, it may be that we have to just give it. It may be that if a property cannot figure phenomenologically in perception, then it will not be possible for it to figure phenomenologically in imagining. And all we can do in either case is to pretty crudely think about it. So maybe you can't see something to be John Wayne. Maybe you can just see something with certain characteristics that may go well beyond just shape and colour. They may include having a certain gait, having a certain bearing, a demeanour, whatever. But maybe the John Wayne bit eludes you, and all you can do is form the belief that you're on the basis of your perception, i.e. the phenomenological presence, of these other features. If that's so, it's similar for imagining. If that's so in both cases, getting the content into the states that go with perception or with the imaginings can only be a matter of pure thought. So at some point we may have to do it. But it is only at that point that we will give in to Ryle's worry that imagining has been provided for temperament. We'll give in to Ryle's thought that imagining is an intellectually more sophisticated and more demanding activity than we see. Only at that point will it be able to think. And indeed, it won't be more intellectually sophisticated than perceiving with respect to the relevant content. It'll just be more sophisticated than the most great basics of imagining. So you can still imagine horses in a non-sophisticated way, but if to get red running you have to have thoughts about red run, that's where sophistication lies. Alright, let me finish briefly by asking how ideal all this is. In other words, how far have I fulfilled my ambitions? So let me remind you of the structure that I've imposed on both perceiving and imagining. That's what this little table gives you. In the case of both perceiving and imagining, we've really got two kinds of elements. We've got something you might think of being given, some sort of property, and the property in question is perspectival. The givenness, in the case of perceiving, is being presented with it. In the case of imagining, it's conjuring it. But either way, that is, as it were, the basic materials out of which the state is built. And then we get further by doing something I call placing the given in a sensory profile, the profile of some other property, a non-perspectival property. In the case of perception, that's achieved by forming expectations. In the case of imagining, it's achieved by undertaking commitments. Now, both of these columns involve things that make a difference to phenomenology. Right? It's been an important part of my story that we enrich the phenomenology of the given when you place it in a profile. And in neither case, perceiving nor imagining, does the enriching involve anything like mere intellectual content? It doesn't involve beliefs or pure thoughts. So you might ask me this question. Why isn't the enriching, the forming of expectations or of commitments, itself just more sensation? What's the distinction between the sensing and the knowing if the knowing stuff doesn't look much like knowing? It's not very thinky and it is quite phenomenological. Fair question. But here's my answer. There's still an important distinction between the two columns, between the given column and the place in the profile. Let's suppose that sensation is just that, the intrinsic nature of which determines phenomenology. So sensation is that, the intrinsic nature of which determines phenomenology. That description only fits the first column, the being presented or conjuring some perspectival property. What goes in the second column does indeed make a difference to phenomenology. It enriches the phenomenology of the whole. But it doesn't do so by appeal to, by just exploiting the intrinsic nature of anything. Rather, what you do when you form expectations or commitments is take other possible sensations and tack a range of them to change the phenomenology of your current state. So the second column alters phenomenology by drawing on merely possible sensation and tapping, if you like, power of a full range of such things. So it won't count as sensation if my little stab at defining sensation is right. And I like my stab at defining sensation, so I'm going to stop here. Okay. So what I just said is, being given is indeed a matter of sensation, or something like sensation. You want to distinguish between presenting and conjuring? Sure. But why would you be unhappy with conjuring? Because you would think it was basically sensation, right? Like basically agree with. So to that extent, not very Riley. So how can I claim to have pursued Riley ambitions to any degree? Well, the answer is, I want to minimise the role in sensory imagining of that which is conjuring. The project that this paper kind of sets up is to try to make sense of as many features of sensory imagining as possible by appeal to the non-sensation element. Placing in a profile by undertaking commitments.
I can't really do any of that today, especially not now, it's late hour. But let me just give you one thing to try and make you persuade you that the project's not hopeless. So you might say this about my claim that sensory imagining has as its core the conjuring, the summoning of perspectival properties. You might say, well, that's quite hard for me to do. Conjuring visible figures, it's quite hard, actually. If I try and picture a horse, then maybe, sure, I can get a horse, a little bit of a horse in one profile here, different profile there, maybe a rear fetlock there, an ear here. But it's all very unstable and fleeting. And I agree with you, it is. Now, as a whole, sensory imagining is unstable and fleeting. It's very hard for most of us to fix, either in vision or in hearing or in any other imaginative state, anything very to discern it for very long. But there's a disparity between the two with respect to how unstable they are. When it comes to the summoning of perspectival appearances, things are much more unstable and fleeting, at least I find, than when it comes to summoning the rest of imaginative contents. And if that's so, then that would be good news for my view, because it suggests that what does the work in determining imaginative contents is in large part placing in profiles, and only in small part conjuring perspectival properties. Okay, thank you for your time.